And then one night she's like, "Don't go away, stay in the room." And he's like, "Okay, but we'll just sleep." And then she like puts on one of his shirts and he's like, "That's the sexiest thing I've ever seen."
I gotta be honest, we see Isla a lot in this book and scenes of intimacy in her, and like, that girl does not pull her weight. I just wanna just say that overall.
I don't wanna use the term pillow princess, but I'm gonna use the term pillow princess. Hi guys, and welcome to another episode of, god damn it, my camera's just, the autofocus is like.
Hey guys, we're Unresolved Textual Tension. I'm your rugged and handsome host, Will, and with me is my lovely co-host,
Maria. How you doing, guys?
And today we are doing the sequel to Lightlark. Lightlark, for those who don't know, kind of took Book Talk by storm, a year or two ago now, and it was like everybody thought that the author was an industry plant because she got a movie deal. And the book itself, Lightlark, we reviewed. You can check it out. This is early enough in the video that I actually probably will put up a card showing where you can click on the sequel. But basically speaking, it was like Death Competition ACOTAR Light. Like, yeah. That's kind of the vibe, by way of middle grade fantasy.
And Will and I both didn't, we didn't think it was a good book, but we just, the absolute fervor on the internet about how terrible the book was. And here's the thing, like I said, I don't think it's good, but there are things that the same people who are like, this is a terrible book, thought were good, that I thought were not good. And so the ruler by which they were measuring felt tinted more so by dislike of the whole Aster situation than for the, because like reading it, it feels so ACOTAR-ish that I am I'm completely blown away by the fact that like the Book Talk community like
has a different opinion of it than ACOTAR.
They really like hung it outside the city walls as a warning to others. Meanwhile, the books sitting on the throne inside look very, and I'm going to make an argument, book two hammers that home. So yeah, we didn't think Lightlark was good. There were some things that I thought were like okay and like not too bad. Like I didn't hate the romance. I didn't like love it, but it didn't like make me cringe inside. Or at least the romance with Oro in the first book.
Do you know his name is Oro Rey? Oro is gold in Spanish. So it's Gold King in Spanish. I did not realize that because I only listened to the audiobook. Let me Google that really quick to make sure I'm right. I only listened to the audiobook, so I didn't pick up on that. But yeah, that's his name, which is like the goofiest fantasy name.
Her names for stuff is terrible. It's when I tell you this woman has some of the, like, sometimes Will talks about how the names of like fantasy lands are just overly complicated and like they're working off of like a made up basis that is hard to versus, and he's made like examples of Game of Thrones, Take a Shot. We're like Winterfell, easy to remember, you know, the Highgarden. Like the names are distinct, but they tell you about the place by their naming convention, and it's like not terrible to follow.
Not the case here.
No, this is too simplistic. And everyone just roasted her for Miss Aster for wildling night or starling, skyling, sunling.
And don't get me wrong, it is pretty stupid.
That's one of the again dumbest naming conventions. But it's like she realized that she couldn't name the hot night people nightlings, so she called them nightshades. And it's just like you decided to get creative there, but then you just stopped out. Like everything just has the most dumb conventional names.
I said this about the first one, but it feels very middle grade. A girl wrote this in middle grade, and it's like, okay, for a 13 to 15 year old, it's cute. You came up with a thing. The world is like, you know, everybody has their faction thing like Avatar, and like it's like, okay, this is kind of harmless. But then the book itself is so long that you're just like, oh.
And
God.
It has semi-graphic sex scenes.
Like so
like,
much.
I wouldn't call it like graphic or like super spicy. It's more like back in the day. back in the day when you went to, what was that one website? But like a term for like fan fictions was lemon and lime. So lemon was so more stupid. Spicy. Lime was like downplayed. And so this definitely feels lime-esque, not lemon. But it just like when those moments would happen, because like the thing is, Isla, this woman uses the name Isla, which has an S in it, but it's silent. But it is a name. It is a name that people have, Isla, and decides the S is going to be pronounced. So she's Isla. But Isla feels, for the most part, like I would have preferred this so much more, I think, if it had just been a middle grade book. Isla was just a 17-year-old girl figuring out her shit and figuring out who she was. It's aged up. I'm pretty sure she's like 20 or 22. And then like the sex side of things, just like every time it happens, you're like, oh, why are we doing this?
Yeah. And the thing about it is, you know, I talked about this a little bit in Divine Rivals, which made me realize it, but like I'm over sex scenes in books. No more. I am the moral majority now. I don't like it. Because what I realized about it is in Divine Rivals, it's very sort of understated and it's kind of sweet. And it made me realize that in books like ACOTAR and all of the romanticy books we've read, it's almost leering and in your face, and not violating per se because it's a book, but it's literally like the author is just looking at you and spilling over their cleavage, so to speak. Like, it's almost that feeling of like the author's sexuality is impinging on you, and I just don't like it. It's so crude and just gross, and so I'm kind of done with it unless there's a very specific point in the story for it.
It's really interesting because I had a conversation with a friend of mine who read Fourth Wing and enjoyed it and thought it was just like fun popcorn, and then I was recommending another book to her and she goes, does it have spice in it? And I went, no. And then she was like, eh. And I realized, oh, there's just a portion of the population where that is what they, and like, no judgment. I love Sarah. She's a great, like, she's an awesome flipping human. But like, that's what she wants. When she wants a book, she wants mind candy with some spice in it. Like, that's what she's looking for. And so my recommendation, as much as I think it's a really good book, doesn't meet, like, I didn't even tell her the name of the book once I heard that, because like, it's not going to meet her criteria if that's it. And so I think there just is a portion of the population that just wants their spicy girl fantasy, and they're gonna be okay with it. And the thing is, I don't think it works here. The characters feel like, one of the problems I have with ACOTAR is that Farrah just feels, especially in the later books, too old for her age. And so like, you forget sometimes that she's fucking 19 or whatever young-ass age she is. And so the stuff that happens in it feels more like it fits the setting. Here, Isla feels very young. And so when it does happen, and I think that's part of the reason why I liked the romance with Oro more. More the first book, because there was no spice. And in this book, there also is, like, there's one scene. It's more touching and sweet than it is, like, gross sexy.
But the thing is, the book does it where it's like, oh, and her, she was wearing her lacy things. And it's like, oh, and she was, like, spilling out. And it's like, it's this weird, like, not quite. It's like porn written for teenagers. And I don't mean that in, like, a creepy way. But just, like, it feels like somebody took, like, a teenage vocabulary and understanding of the world and wrote that as porn versus being an adult writing about actual sexual interactions people have with each other. And I should state, just going back very quickly, I am totally okay if people want smut. I think it's fine to write smut. I even think it's fine to write extremely problematic smut. It's just that there's a difference between smut books and actual books that are meant to, like, tell themes and stuff. And you can do one through the other. There is a very high-class erotica, but that's, like, a whole thing. But in general, romanticy tends to push the two together in a way that I find uncomfortable. And so specifically what Maria's seeing here, yeah, it doesn't really serve the plot. It doesn't really, her sexual awakening via Grimm could be telling a story, and it isn't, because it's just very kind of like, and he had, like, bulging muscles, guys.
She never saw someone so attractive naked. And it just, you really could fade to black those scenes, and nothing about the the story would change. And that's the problem for me, and that Will is establishing, is if we can fade to black and nothing about the scene, like the story changes or the impact on the character changes, then you probably didn't need an explicit sex scene. And I think that a lot of the time, like in ACOTAR and stuff, but at least it just fits the tone there a little bit. Like, the book itself, the entirety of ACOTAR is just so flippin' thirsty that, like, the sex scenes kind of fit the tone more. I don't want to be seen as an ACOTAR sympathizer.
What it is that this book feels younger than ACOTAR.
It does. It feels so much younger.
So it feels even more out of place. Where, like, with Farrah, you're like, okay, whatever. And then Isla also is a very insecure kind of character, more so than Farrah is, which then makes it feel even a little bit weirder when she's having, like, more sexy time interactions with people, because it makes her feel younger.
This book has weird descriptions to just talk about other stuff other than the weird sex scenes.
Before we jump into that, let's talk for a minute about the plot. What is the premise of this for people who get annoyed that we start too early?
So, Lightlark is... We're going to do a very brief summary of the end of Lightlark. There were these... everything was fine until the nightshades attacked. So there are these different groups of people that all, like, have different powers. They're the Sunlings, the Lings, the Ling people, okay? And they have been under a curse for 500 years, and every 100 years there is a centennial thing where the rulers from all the realms have to come together and try break the curse, which involves killing one of the rulers, which would also then kill their entire realm. And they've been trying for 500 years how to figure out how to not kill an entire realm of people but still break the curses. The curse affects each of the different realms differently, some really dumbly, some way more harshly. It's really dumb.
One of them, they all die at 25, and the other one, they can't travel over water.
Yeah, that's it. You know, like, so some of them are doing just fucking fine. Some of them, like, you can't fly anymore. Some of them, you have to eat hearts to live now. You can't eat anything else, which is just such a colossal waste of resources.
Oh my, like, gosh, they still keep it up in this book. Yeah,
it's so... But anyway, and so they're all... Everyone's cursed. Nobody heckin' likes it. And it also means that they've all been separated from Lightlark, because outside of the space of the Centennial, there's a terrible storm that goes around Lightlark, which is like a collection of islands. And the Lightlark is where... They're all originally from, but they've all kind of scattered to different lands. And they've come together during the centennial in the Lightlark book. And our main character, Isla Crown.
I hate that they pronounce the S so much.
And also Crown. Her last name is Crown. Anyway, Isla Crown is a young... She's like 20. She is the wildling ruler, but she ain't got no power. Got nothing. And she has her friend Celeste, who's the ruler of the Starling, the people that die at 25. And Celeste is like, we need to break the curses for our nation, and we're gonna do it this way through this other thing. And basically, she gets to know the king named Isla gets to know the king, this guy named Aro. Her and him are trying to find the heart of Lightlark to maybe help break the curses. Then there's this, like, hot shadow wielder nightshade guy named Grimshaw, and he's like, oh, do you like chocolate? And they kind of get close, but she's like, you're supposed to be an evil monster. And he's like, am I? And then she falls for him, but she also falls for the king, and the king has also fallen in love with her, and he's super powerful. He has, like, four different powers, because each realm is only supposed to have one, but he has four of them. And Isla has no powers. She's the only person who doesn't have powers, and she's been trying her best to hide it this whole time. How she managed to succeed in that, the story goes to great pains to make that at all plausible. But anyway, at the end, her friend Celeste turns out to be a hacking traitor and one of the people that helped the curses be created to begin with, and has been alive this whole time and has just been pretending to die over and over again and taking over power in the Starling realms. And she's evil, and she betrays Isla and gets Isla's powers, because as you find out, Isla does have powers, but her father was actually a nightshade. Her mother was the queen of the wildlings. And so Isla has nightshade and wildling powers combined inside her, so that they're so tangled up with each other, she can't use either of them. So she thought she was powerless, but actually she's super powerful the whole time. And then through her, they have this dumb thing in this book where if someone is in love with you, you have access to their powers. If you're in love with them, they have access to your powers. So when Celeste slash Aurora gets access to Isla's powers through this thing called the Bond Breaker or Bond Maker, she also gets access to Aro, the king's powers, and Grimm. But also, Grimm's kind of working with Celeste. And then you find out that Grimm actually had been her boyfriend for about a year before this entire tournament, but had wiped her memory so she wouldn't remember any of it, and was kind of working with Celeste this whole time. And you're like, holy fucking shit. But then she realizes she has access to Aro's powers, and she's in love with him, but she doesn't have access to Grimm's powers, because in this moment, she's no longer in love with him. She defeats Celeste slash Aurora, kills her with the Bond Breaker, so she gets access to her powers, and now she also takes all of the Starling power into herself so that all the Starlings don't die. Convenient plot device. And there's also a door in a castle that's the Wildling Castle that she really wants to open, but she can't. And that's book one.
I'm so impressed you remembered any of that, because I started this book and I could remember so little of the bullshit lore that became so important in the last eighth of that book, because that book really was like that. Like, you had a bunch of like plot and things happening, and then all of a sudden at the end there was a bunch of info dumping about why these 2000 year old people are doing the things they're doing, and I retained almost none of it for this book. And actually, this book, you really don't need to know it, really. Like, all you really need to know is that Grimshaw is Rysand, and that Oro is boring and not an old guy like me and Maria thought initially. He's actually a normal age.
Despite being thousands of years old, this book has weird aging conventions, but it's fine.
So much of this world that is just a little kid putting things in their magical world because they wanted to, and then not actually thinking about, like, oh, what is the economy of hearts? If we all have to eat hearts, where are we getting these hearts from? Constantly speaking? Yeah, no.
And also, why didn't we hear at all in the last book that the Starlings were being subjugated, and that all the other kingdoms were killing the Starlings and using them as slaves because they were disposable because they die at 25?
Yeah, that was weird. Yeah,
this doesn't fit in with anything.
Again, I think the author just kind of did what she thought was cool at times, because yeah, she does at times like try to tell more lore about the world, and it like never connects in a way that's interesting to anything else. Like, all of a sudden at one point we find out that wildling rulers all wildlings essentially get to match with a cool animal companion, and like Isla just didn't know about this. Like, she knew they could do it, but she didn't know it was like a regular thing.
So this is a huge problem, is you get this scene, this cool bonding ceremony thing where she has to get her animal companion. There's no gravitas. This book struggles, and it's weird because like the descriptions aren't terrible, like they're just very functional in some ways, and all they're pretty, but there is no emotional oomph, there's no tension, there is no gravitas. That's a huge problem with the entire book. The stakes never feel very high, and it's through this is a book that I would like you and Katie to look at for the critique stream, because why are scenes that should have a punchy emotional impact? Now, part of this is because she does this thing where she tells you what the character is feeling, and then she describes the aftermath of that feeling, but you never get to experience that. Like, there's a ton of times where she, like, tells you the thing, and then she just skips ahead, and she doesn't describe it or really set the scene for it. But it's just bizarre to me how little in a lot of ways, this book was easier for me to read than, like, Fourth Wing or Iron Flame. It's boring, but it was, like, less violently annoying to me. And I do think, in some ways, Aster is a better writer. But she's also a more boring writer.
I would have, yes. The thing is that we have suffered through both Sarah J. Maas and Rebecca Yarros, the Iron Flame Fourth Wing, which is Sarah J. Maas, but worse. And so this is almost Sarah J. Maas, but a different incarnation where things are less, again, violently offensive and more subtly boring. Like, there's, like, less.
The one thing I will give to Sarah J. Maas is she knows how to how to give a scene gravitas. Like, and she can write a decent creepy action scene. Too. She can write great action. Like, the things that I like that are the only things I like about Sarah J. Maas's books are just completely missing here. And so, and there's a lot of stuff like that is just like, and I wrote down, there's two descriptions that I think really solidify that Astor is kind of like not a terrible as far as like syntax, word flow writer, but she just doesn't really understand a lot of what she's writing down.
She's like a very talented 15-year-old writer. Like, you know what I mean? Like, that's the kind of thing when you read that and you're like, oh wow, you're gonna be a real writer when you grow up. But she's like 30,
and it's almost like if she continues to write, I can see her, like, if she continues to write and she learns from it and she doesn't just like bathe in the success of sales, I can see her becoming a better writer. But unfortunately, you don't know if that's going to happen.
The current publishing industry does not really help writers grow. It sort of actively hurts that. Leigh Bardugo is the only writer who I've seen who gets consistently better with her. Well, not always consistently better, but she has gotten better from some of her earlier work. But I'm a little bit confused. Okay, because earlier you said you would really like me and Katie to look at this in one of our critique streams. But what does that mean? Is this a critique stream? No. Do we do normal episodes on our YouTube channels? How does that work?
So, how it works is we have a Patreon that you should join for the myriad of cool benefits you can have. Tier 1, we have our regular patrons who get access to our fancy schmancy Discord, which is a really cool place with lots of really cool people who write, who share the things they're interested in, the shows they're watching, the different fandoms they're parts of, but also a lot of writing advice, a lot of like book craft work, and also just other publishing stuff like, what did you use to design your book cover? What did you use to like bind your books? Like, what websites are you using for these different things? So super useful. We have a lot of people who self-publish. So great resource there. And just like,
I also have to give it to our patrons on the Discord. They're actually very funny. I've been hanging out on the Discord more recently, and like, they're some of the few people I find who are genuinely really funny. And so like, it's a good time. It's kind of, they kind of very much have the vibe we have because they got to our content because they like us. So it's sort of a similar vibe to here. One of the things I really appreciate is that in discussions, everybody is like very respectful, very but also very tough, or not tough, but just very precise. And if they feel like something's not good, they'll just say it, and they'll say what it is, and it's not necessarily a contentious thing. But I think that level of media analysis is just lacking in so many places. It's really nice to find people who are good with that.
Absolutely. And it's great. One of my favorite things when we're reading books that we're gonna do with our patrons, which happens at level 2, the book club members, where we twice a month we do a live stream with our book club members for books. The mid-month live stream, Will picks the book. Apparently the book he picked this month is Killing Katie Slowly. And then at the end of the month book, the patrons nominate a bunch of books, and then we/Will slims it down to 5, and then there's a vote to rank them and see which one we're going to read. And so a fourth of all of our videos that we publish is picked. The books we're reading are picked by our patrons. And half of all the videos we put out that are long are ones where we are interacting with our patrons. So it's a great time. But the thing that I love is the threads in the Discord specifically discussing the books we're reading, because it's a great if I have feelings about a book, I'll go and I'll see like how other people are vibing, or sometimes like if I'm like, oh, I don't know where this is heading, I'll look for like just kind of the vibes of the group. And it's really interesting. Sometimes I'm loving a book and they're not loving it, or sometimes I'm disliking a book and they're loving it, and sometimes we're like, we're right on course. But regardless of that, we've always been able to have really productive, good discussions kind of going over everything, and it's fantastic. It's one of my favorite parts of doing this whole podcast.
Have you ever been part of a book club and been annoyed that nobody reads it? Well, don't worry, we have about 100 people in our book club, so someone will have read it.
Yes.
And that's kind of the nice thing, especially our old standbys. Shout out to several of our patrons, but I don't want to name them because I feel like if I leave out one of the names, I'm going to feel bad. But there's like a good 7 or 10 who always comment, and shout out to you guys.
And then our last tier is our Parasocial Darlings, which are what we were discussing before, the critique streams once a month. K- Katie and William, generally the first Saturday of every month, Katie and Will sit down and they look at the prose of a book to see how something works or not works. The most recent one that they did, which I'm super excited to watch because I flippin' love the book, they analyzed a horror slash scary scene from Maggie Stiefvater's book Scorpio Races, which Will and I read previously for the channel and flippin' loved, and Katie read recently on her own because of how much we liked it, and so they got to look at a fantastically like tense scary scene and look at how it works, and it just I'm so excited to see that because, I mean, for me, that would be super useful for my own writing one day when I ever do it again. And so those are, like, really fantastic. They pick different books and they look at it for good and for ill. You know, why doesn't something work? Why does something work? How is this author able to convey a certain thing through the prose of the book? It's a fantastic time and you should join.
And this time we didn't even go off topic and talk about genitals for an hour. So you're welcome, everyone.
Character growth. It's happening.
You know, if you can't afford the Patreon, which we understand, money is tough, but you still want to support the channel, hit the like button or comment. Those two actually do sincerely affect how well a video does. And more than anything, it just also makes us very happy. In our latest video that no one watched by the metrics, everyone commented on it who did watch it, and that felt so nice.
It was insane. It was a silly thing where I said something like, we could talk about fish for an hour and nobody would notice, because nobody's gonna watch this, and then we put a hashtag fish if you're so comment fish if you got this far, and it was just the amount of people who did it, and then we had a couple at the end, and it was just so cute, like, and it made us so happy, like, and no way did we think people were going to engage that hard with the like offhanded comment we made, and it was just, it's a great time. We don't always like respond to every comment, but like I see them, I read them, and like a lot of joy. So comment, like, share the video. Even yes. If you just copy the link out of YouTube notes that and thinks, ooh, this is cool, and this person's trying to share it. So
that's the algorithm. We got to trick the machine brain, the ominous Aya.
I want to go through the plot of this really, really quickly because it's not actually that important to the things that don't work in this.
And nothing happens! Oh, Ishwit and the Sarah J. Maas School of My Favorite Thing is to sit around writing about characters in, like, daily lives.
And like, Aro's found family group of friends. Like, it just, like, it's like she saw the second book of ACOTAR and she was like, art. Tis art. Anyway, so this book opens up with our main character, Isla, trying to get back into that room in the Wildling Castle I mentioned. And she can, like, open it now because her crown's the key. But, like, she can't keep the door open. And she's like, I'm not powerful. I'm such a failure. And Aro is like, you just need to train.
Yes, in a transatlantic accent.
Yeah. and Aro's like, you just need to train and you need to learn how to separate your powers and you need to learn how to use them and da-da-da-da. And she's like, no, I don't want to do that for no reason. Like, it's really dumb. She's wanted her entire life to be powerful, and now she has access to, like, three different kinds of powers, and she's just, like, not using it. And then this thing happens where she kind of gets kidnapped and by these people, and then she attacks them using starling magic, and she's like, oh no, I accidentally maybe killed someone. I need to, and he's like, you need to learn how to control your powers, and she's like, okay, I'll learn.
There's a weird theme in this book of, like, emotions and, like, whether that's good because it'll fuel your power or not, but it never goes anywhere, so to even call it a theme is weird. It's just a thing the book keeps noting.
There's also this whole thing of, like, oh, now in the aftermath, because, like, Grimm is fucked off, and he's like, back to Nightshade lands, and he's like, what enemies now? And she's like, how dare he, I hate him. But they're also like, who's going to be the ruler of Starling? Because, like, Isla has the power of Starling, and she's, this book series has this really dumb rule where if the ruler dies, everybody dies, and it does try to explain that in this book. It's dumb.
It's too big of a change. It sounds, here's the thing, if you're a teenager, and again, that's kind of how I think of the author, writing a fantasy book, it sounds like a cool idea, but the actual implications of if your ruler dies, everyone in your country dies, super weird. Every moment of her life, Eisley should be thinking about it. It's literally the whole Fisher King idea of like the king's will, the king's health is the land's health. The king's health is literally the people's health in this case. She should never be making every time she makes any kind of a like, I'm going to go into battle for my friends kind of decision. It should be like, well, okay, but if I die, I'm killing hundreds of thousands of people. I don't actually know how many wildlings there are. There's a weird thing where, like, the scale of the world doesn't totally make sense, but...
And unfortunately, the rulers of the different, while under the curse, they can't go to the centennial if they have an heir, because that means if one of them isn't killed, the curse isn't actually broken. Because, like, if you have an heir, your power will just get transferred over to them. And so, like, for 500 years, none of the rulers were technically supposed to have an heir. And, like, it's just... It's messy. But anyway, so Isla's like, I'll take over ruling Starling because I have their power. And the Starling people are like, yes, we had no hope of a long life and now you gave it to us. So we're totally okay with you, Aranda. We don't even know doing this. And the Starling people also now were apparently being like abused and subjugated by the other lands because they only live to 25. Even though we don't have any... in the previous book, any evidence of the lands interacting at all. Like, they just felt very isolated from each other.
That felt really weird. Like, it literally was like a second order world building thing she kind of thought about and decided to bring in, but like the seeds of it aren't laid in the first book.
During her coronation for to becoming the wildling, or the Starling ruler, she has to get coronated, and a rift opens in the earth, and a bunch of, like, these terrible lizard men pop out with wings, and they, like, they're attacking everyone. Oro tries to save her, and she's, like, again, useless, doesn't have powers, isn't doing anything, even though she's trying to, and then they're like, oh, those must be creatures of the Nightshade, that was Grimm, he did this, he sent us this, horde of evil beasts that just massacred a bunch of people. And she's like, I need to train. So she's like, I need to figure out how to separate my powers and access to them. And he's like, I have an idea, but I don't think you'll like it. That was Oro. And also, her and Oro are established to be in love with each other, but they don't kiss, they don't hug. They hug a little, and like they're like hand on shoulder affectionate. Or, like, if she's sad, he'll put his hands on her face. But, like, they're just kind of avoiding. And part of this is he's like, you are not doing great. She's real skinny. She's not sleeping. Like, she's not doing well. The events of recent has not affected her well. Anyway, they go to this guy who was in the first book, who's this kind of, like, weird, I don't want to say bat creature, but he was a weird guy.
Yeah, that looks about right. Yeah. I had forgotten about him.
I had too until he popped up in this book and then I remembered. And he's like a weird ancient creature. And he's at the end of the last book, he was like, don't worry, wildling ruler, you shall come to me of your own volition someday. And they do now. And he's like, I shall help you untangle your powers. And he does. And she like is overcome by power. She hits the earth one hand, births a forest the other hand, demolishes everything in its path, and she's like, no. And so then her and Oro start training to figure out how to like control her powers, and she has a really hard time with it. And these scenes are like not as useful as they should be. Training montages and books like are unfortunate in that they can be really boring to write, but are some are really necessary to making things feel earned. And the book spends a lot of time in her initial stages of training for her wildling magic, but spends zero time in scene for her nightshade powers. And so it's just really unbalanced and weird. But anyway, she learns to kind of take control of her powers. And Oro is really big on, you know, not using emotion, being controlled, not letting your powers control you. Yada yada. She learns that Oro has friends. He has, like, their... it's Sunling, but it's also Skyling and Moonling, and he has this host of guys. Like,
it's literally the scene in Court of Mist and Fury where suddenly we meet Cassian and Azriel, and it's like, these are his buddies and they banter a lot, and there's even one girl and two guys in the way that all these friends groups are. It felt very like ACOTAR light in that way.
It really did. And one of them is a Sunling named Enya, who like, has been one of Aro's friends. And because, like, the wildlings are struggling because they've just been eating hearts for 500 years, but now they have to, like, grow plants and apparently completely lost the knack for cultivating food, even though their literal realm's power is growing things.
Yeah, that was weird.
How do you forget how to grow shit when you can literally sprout plants?
Or even hunt is another thing they should theoretically be able to do.
Yeah, like, it's bizarre. But anyway, so she, Enya, goes to help them, the wildlings, figure out their stuff. But eventually, after her nightshade, her powers are untangled, she starts getting some of her memories back from her time with Grimm that she doesn't remember from a year ago, and she remembers, like, how they met the first time, and basically it's an enemies to lovers, but, like, for reals this time, because I think it was kind of sold that way in the first book, but it really wasn't. But this time it is, where, like, they really don't like each other. She, like, stabs him upon their first meeting in the first book, and then, like, they antagonize each other, but then eventually they start, like, working together for a common goal, because he needs her to do something. But these dreams are really fucking with her. She doesn't like having them, and it's making her very anxious, so she stops trying to sleep. Aro notices and is like, what the fuck is happening? And she tells him, and he's like, okay, come sleep in my bed. Because she's like, I just remember him in my room a lot. And he's like, well, why don't you just sleep in my room? And at first, like, Aro is sleeping, he's sleeping somewhere else and not in her bed. But she's like sitting there like, please just do stuff with me. Look, I'd really like to get hot and heavy. And he's like, no, you're not doing well. But then, like, she starts sleeping more because she's in his bed and she's wearing his nightshirts and she's feeling better and she really likes this guy. And then one night she's like, don't go away, stay in the room. And he's like, okay, but we'll just sleep. And then she, like, puts on one of his shirts and he's like, that's the sexiest thing I've ever seen. And then, like, she kind of begs him to do stuff, and they do stuff.
Again, the sex scenes are just very overly sexual for the rest of the content, and also for the emotional caliber of the characters. It just feels awkward.
And this one is, like, the least awkward of them. It's a bit more vague. It's mainly her, him for her kind of stuff, and it feels a little sweeter because Aro just is.
I gotta be honest. We see Isla a lot in this book and scenes of intimacy in her, and, like, that girl does not pull her weight. I just want to just say that overall. That girl, like,
I don't want to use the term pillow princess, but I'm going to use the term pillow princess. That happens. She's doing better. She's sleeping more. And then she, like, goes to the wildling realm because she's, like, trying to help there. And then they're like, oh, it's weird that you never got a bonded. And she's like, you're right. You all have animals that just, like, hover around you. Like, the one lady's got a snake wrapped around her arm. The other one has a bird that flits about. And they're like, oh, yes, the bonding ceremony. We were all surprised you didn't do it. And she's like, yes, the bonding ceremony. I know exactly what you're talking about. And the lady's like, and she's like, I'll do it. And she's like, you'll do the bonding ceremony. And instead of it being, because, like, the bonding ceremony, she has to go out and she has to hunt. Or, like, other people, like, the normal schlebs just go out, they find an animal that they bond to, and, like, they're good. And once the animal, like, lets them touch them, it's all good. But if you're a ruler, for no apparent fucking reason, you have to shoot the animal you're gonna bond with an arrow. Which, honestly, sounds to me like the best way to start internal friendship. You know, like, arrow shooting. I don't know why I didn't do that sooner. I'd have more friends.
So the thing about this is that in the previous book, basically Isla, because she didn't have powers, had been kept sheltered by Poppy and somebody else, or basically her two, like, nannies.
Kira, Lyra, yeah.
Yeah, something like that. And it was, like, you know, for her safety, but then also we figured out they murdered her parents, and so it was like, oh, and so she had banished them. And so basically one of the things that she mentioned in this book is that she doesn't really know the wildlings, she doesn't, her people, very well, because she had been kept so far away from them. And so, like, there could have been an interesting idea there of her reconnecting with her people and learning what it is to be one of them, because she also kind of wants to stay on Lightlark. She doesn't really want to go back and live with them, and then, like, how is she supposed to rule them like that? And so, like, theoretically, this is kind of an interesting, like, her, this is, could be an interesting moment of her kind of interacting with a culture that's hers but she doesn't quite understand, but that is not played with in the novel at all. Like, it, no. That is way, everything is very surface level.
It's so surface level, because this lady goes out, the bonding ceremony, and the next thing you know, she's in a pond getting ready to do the bonding ceremony, and the lady's like, well, good luck, here's your arrow, and Isla has to fuck off. But it's bizarre because this is supposed to be like a very important ceremony to them, and their ruler having a big impressive bonded animal is a sign of the ruler's strength. And also she could die, because in the quest to find her bonded animal, she could find animals she's not bonded to and she could die. So the fact that the entire wildling community is not there to see her off and wait, like, she should be covered in flowers and their well wishes. They should be singing as they let her off, and but they can't cross a certain point, and it is a moment of trust between people and ruler.
And the ruler,
and it's this moment of them being like, we trust you to take this journey, come back to us, kind of like, and it should have gravitas.
It's actually a druidic moment in that this is them giving all of their lives to nature, essentially. You know, nature will now judge them, and they will connect to nature through their,
There's none of that, and it really should be, like, it's just bizarre. She's just by herself in a puddle, and then she goes out, and then, like, she gets attacked by, like, this bear with horns that's made out of, like, bark, and, like, she nearly dies, and then this, like, jaguar comes up and is like, you're mine, and then literally takes her, because she, like, shoots her arrow at a previous point and it misses and breaks in half, and so the jaguar literally, it's a giant, by the way, jaguar, like its legs are above her head, like the and like the height anyway. And it takes her to where the arrow fell, and it's like, okay, stab me with the arrow now. And it's just, like, a bizarre scene, and they're like, oh, that's Lynx, your mother's jaguar. And she was like, you are my mother's bonded. And then Lynx just fades into the background of importance, and is just, like...
And the thing is, I actually kind of like this in that it's a funny inversion of... The main character has a cool animal special companion, in that her cool animal special companion kind of doesn't think she's shit. Like, he just doesn't really look, he looks down on her, really. And, like, I kind of thought that was funny, but, like, nothing is really done with it. And it's just, like, an element that was put in because the author thought it was cool.
And that's honestly what it feels like, because the development of their relationship is so surface level, and it happened, like, you forget Lynx exists, and then she pops back into the wildling realm because, like, he's too big to take to the palace. And stuff like why you literally are sleeping in the bed with the king. You guys couldn't have made him. Oh, also, she gives Lynx the choice. Do you want to come with me or do you want to stay here? And he's like, no, this is my home. He doesn't speak, but they, like, vibe. And so she's just like, okay. And, like, she keeps going back and forth. While she's, like, trying to get closer to and help her wildlingy people, she also, is trying to help the starlings, and then she gets a vision of a bunch of death and destruction caused by Grimm, and, like, just utter, like just rain of death, and she's like, oh no, I've had a vision of the future, he's going to come and attack. And then they get a note from Grimm saying, you've got, like, 23 days until we come and attack, expect destruction, you can join us or expect destruction. And they're like, no way, we're going to join that asshole, we've got to prepare for war. The moonlings fuck off just immediately, they've got a fleet of ships, they just fuck off back to their realm, and they're like, we're joining the nightshades.
This happens way too late in the book, is the thing. This is, like, a good, like, I want to say, like, at least a fourth of the way through the book, this tension is set up.
It's halfway.
It's half. And so the first half is literally just her kind of dealing with trauma and going from thing to thing. There's no real spine of the book. Like, we skipped so many scenes that are just nothing scenes of her, like, feeling insecure and, like, not doing anything. And that's one of the problems with the book, is that just the structure of it, nothing happens. And it would be much stronger if there was an overriding tension that then led into different, like, like, adventures or level ups or something like that. But this happens just very late in the book.
So now they're preparing for war. And so they need to get people. Also, they discover that the Skylings, who have a democratic society, despite the fact that they have one ruler who has all the fucking power, and if he dies, they all die, but it's still a democratic society, are voting about whether they're going to stay and fight this war. They're trying to, like, convince the Skylings to do it, but she's also like, we need more people. We lost Moonlings, Skylings not. And so they decide, there's this group of people who kind of live in the snow.
Who are just Nords. They're just the Norse.
they used to be, like, they hate wildlings. I think they used to be Nightshade people, is the implication. And so there's a bunch of people you meet that used to be a type of this group, but they're separated, which is supposed to be impossible. But anyway, so they go and they're like, fight with us. And then the guy's like, no, I'm going to kill you. I tried to kill you before. And then she shows her night powers and he's like, never mind, mama, we're here. That's it. Like, complete about face. And then she's like, perfect, you'll fight with us. And he was like, yeah, but actually, because she's like, how many are you? And he's like, hundreds. And she's like, yeah. And he goes, but actually, most of us are sick with a plague, so we can't do shit. And so then she has to try to find a thing. And she's like, looking into the wildlings have this like one purple flower that makes their healing elixir, which apparently is fucking endless, based on how liberally it is used all the time. But anyway, they only have a couple patches and they don't want to wipe it all out for fear of never being able to get it back again. And so, but she tries to use some of the nightling, wilding elixir. And again, this flower doesn't have a name for most of the book. They just keep referring to the flower of the wilding elixir. And the wilding elixir is just called the wilding elixir, the healing elixir. Just no naming convention. The thing is the thing. It's a healing elixir. Mm-hmm. It's from the wildlings. Wildling healing elixir. You're done. But anyway, and while this is happening, she's still having more visions. Like, she realizes with Grimm coming to attack that she might have in her memories a key to why he is doing this. So she needs to start remembering again and trying to get access to them. So she needs to start training her Nightshade powers. So she goes back to, like, the bat guy, and he starts training her. The starlings have a child who's really super fat powerful that nothing really happens with in this book. You just know she exists, and you're immediately like, okay, that's the child you give all your starling powers to, and now she can be the leader. I feel like this makes it, and, like, let the starlings have it. Nope, nothing happens.
The author just liked that character archetype of the innocent but powerful child, and so, like, that's just what we got. We just got that character. They don't do anything in the plot. The other thing is that with the flashbacks, the story could have done something kind of interesting, because one of the things we talked about in ACOTAR is that a relationship not working is actually a very interesting topic and not something explored a lot. And so we always made the case that really what happened with Tamlin should have actually been explored, and actually should have been just like not him randomly having a character personality transplant, but could have been built up as like, okay, sometimes relationships don't work. And so what could have been happening in the flashbacks is we could have started to see the ways that Grimjaw, because she was so young, his name isn't Grimjaw, that's from Bleach, sorry. There could have been something where it's like, oh, okay, this is the first person she's met, this is the first man she's met, really interacted with. We could see her love for him being a very naive, flawed thing, and that could be contrasted against how she is with Oro now, in terms of, like, you know, how she's grown as a character, or how this relationship is different, or how Grim kind of took advantage of her naivete and ingenuousness a little bit. But none of that happens at all. It's a very standard enemies to lovers without, like, a lot of consideration.
And there's also a vibe you get that the book is really pulling for this romance more so than her and Aro, which I just hate, because I find them annoying. They definitely got the, like, snarky, like, and they also have the same thing that, like, Feyre and Rhysand have, where, like, their sex scenes,
yeah, it's the exact same fucking thing,
are all, like, snarky, like, nobody can just, like, like, it's just like, it really hits a lot of those notes. It's so
there's lots of I'm gonna devour you shit, and, like,
and also, like, are you like this for me all the time, you wish, like, just,
yes, it's awful. It's so bad. He also calls her a heart eater all the time, and you're like, this isn't cute.
Yes, and then he shortens it every once in a while to heart, and that's, like, the best you get.
I hated so much of their interactions.
She decides to start having the flashbacks again. She trains her nightling powers, and she starts to learn how to use them. And through the flashbacks, one of the things she learns is Grimm told her that, like, pain is power, and that you can use pain and emotion, that you can use emotion to fuel your power, and you can use pain to access negative emotions. And she kind of uses it to, like, shore up some defenses for the wild, like, on Lightlark against Grimm. And Aura's like, what are you doing? Because she's literally, like, she cut her hand to use the pain in her hand, and, like, she's crying blood is coming out of her ears and nose, and she's like, she feels great. And he's like, yo, this is fucked, like, this is really dangerous, you cannot do this. And she's like, Okay, I guess you're right, but she felt so powerful. And you get her and, like, Grimm falling, like, it, like, going from, like, hating each other to liking each other. They go on a quest for a sword, and then, like, at the last minute, he's like, no, I'm, never mind, fuck the sword. And she's like, why? Like, that makes no sense. And then, the sword ends up disappearing and it reappears in the wildling forest, and she gets it and she's like, look, I found the sword. And he confesses that actually that sword's cursed, and he realized that he basically tells her, I knew you're half Nightshade. Your dad was one of my generals. Your dad was one of my subordinates, and now we're fucking. Thanks, I hate it.
I think we knew that from the first book, if I
know, but
correctly.
It's just so bad. But anyway, and that he knew his dad's power was his flare, which is like a secret extra power.
I hate that they call it that.
It's so bad. But anyway, his flare was being immune to curses, and so that since Isla was his daughter, she also had that flare, which is bizarre because at no point have we heard about flares being genetic. It just hasn't come up before up to this point. But anyway, she has the same flair as her father. And that's why when the wildlings were cursed, she had none of she didn't have to eat hearts. She didn't have crazy seduction powers. She wouldn't have to kill the person she was in love with, all that jazz. He was like, I was going to use your life to break the curse on the sword. Because the sword basically has this thing where it is the only weapon that can control this really evil group of creatures, the lizard men's. But it was cursed so that nightshades couldn't use it because people were afraid nightshades would use the sword to attack Lightlark. So it was cursed that if anyone used nightshade powers in vicinity of the sword, it would just poof and disappear away. And so he was going to use Isla too, because these terrible lizard people are appearing out of a rift in his realm and they're attacking people. So he's been for 100 years or so for something.
It feels very resand and like, oh no, there was a secret thing going on that you didn't know about this whole time that makes me a good person. Like, yeah. And it's like, it's very much that kind of reveal, and it feels very cheap. And we're making a lot of comparisons to ACOTAR, and that's because like, it does feel a lot like
that. Oh, don't worry. It's about to get there even more. Like, it's so dumb. She was like, you knew all of this whole time. You knew from the beginning that you would have to kill me to get this power. And he's like, yeah, but I didn't do it. And she's like, fuck you, I never want to see you again. And then he comes back one day and he's injured and he's like dying. And so she learns about the sword. She tells Aro and all of them, like, ah, there's the sword, blah blah blah. And she has another vision where like it's him and he's dying, and she uses her elixir to save him, and like they're like, I like you. They sleep together. They're like weirdly, like they sleep together, but they aren't saying that they're boyfriend, girlfriend. They go on dates. They have a couple dates.
There's a weird thing where it's like, oh, have a dragon as a pet, and then they talk about it a couple. I couldn't figure out if that was supposed to be like a montage, or like, was that supposed to be funny?
I don't get what that. Yeah, there's literally a part where she finds a baby dragon and she's like, let's keep it. You can keep it as a pet. And it's never mentioned again. Maybe he mentioned in the first book that he has a pet dragon, but I cannot for the life of me remember it. If you have read both books, please comment below. I didn't reread the first book for this.
Trauma bond with us.
To have like weird date montages, and eventually she gets this idea that like one of the only ways to stop what is Grimm in the current timeline, the future timeline, takes the entire wildling people into the night realm, just poofs all of them in, and she's like, he stole my people, he must be stopped. And then she's like, he still loves me, I know he still loves me, because she summons him and they have a conversation where he doesn't tell her anything. Like, there's a lot of ways that things could be avoided, and he just doesn't say anything, even though he knows she doesn't remember everything. She's like, he still loves me. She goes to the bat guy and she's like, teach me how to, through the love bond to, take away his access to his powers. And he was like, I shall show you. And then she's like, I'm going to take away the access to his powers so you can kill him. So you guys can kill him because he's too powerful. And they're like, oh my God, this is it. And she's like, I can only do it for a second. And Aura's like, that's all I need. And so then like there's like an oracle who says some stuff not important.
Well, what's hilarious is she's like, oh, we'll talk one last time after this one time we talk. And I'm like, okay, well, let's hurry up and get to that part because you might need the information before it's dramatically important. And like, then she does get it right at the end, and it ends up that like either she'll end up either killing Grimm or Oro. And it's like, oh, which of the two is it gonna be? I have to make a choice.
And it's so weird because she said they phrase it as the fate of Lightlark depends on the choice. And she's like, what choice? And she was like, Grimm or Oro, which is just, I hate when books come down to which guy do you like more? You know, like, it just, and it's not that, like, it's which guy are you gonna kill, but essentially it's which guy do you love more? Like, that's what's happening.
I think the other thing about it is that, like, because this is it's a trope, and we'll talk about it a little more in the climax, but it's a trope I've seen a lot in the romantics we've read, which is that, like, passive women who can't fight is unfeminist, right? And we're talking in the pop psychology view. So we're going to have empowered women, and so they are going to be able to fight. So Farrah can kind of fight, this girl can kind of fight. But then when it comes to the actual moments of decision, it's still sort of them being acted upon by other characters, and then they do get a choice, but it's still very like passive in a way that you wouldn't have for a male character. Like, you would not have a male character sit and watch his two love interests fight and then make a decision about it. So there's still a certain lack of agency, and I understand that this is kind of just what people want to read. Like, let's be like, I get that some people like this amount of level of agency and passivity, but it feels a little bit hypocritical to me at times, because it feels like, oh no, this character is super competent, but then she doesn't actually. Yeah,
it's just like having your cake and eating it too. Like, unfortunately, it doesn't. And I think you can. I think there is a way to do that, but you have to be like smarter.
I think there is. Yeah, no, I agree. But I think the thing is, the author, I just don't think wants to write the character like that. Like, no. The character, they want to write the more passive character, but then they know that the character should have fighting skills, and so they're like, okay, I'm gonna put that in, but then that doesn't actually affect how the plot plays out. Like, almost nothing in the ACOTAR series hinges upon how well Farrah can fight. Like, just almost nothing in it. Whereas you look at something like Kushiel's Dart and the Kushiel series, and like Phaedra, much better character in that one, doesn't fight, but she still does about as much stuff. And you know, she has important decisions to make and is actually really central to the plot. And so there are ways to do it. It's something I think authors aren't interested in.
The battle happens. She is using pain stuff to like just obliterate people. She gets like some of the ancient creatures to come and fight with them. Eventually there's a point where like Grimm's there and Oro's there and they're fighting, and like she's gonna stop his power, and he looks at her and he's like, no. And it's not, he's not upset because she's betraying him. She's like, no, if you kill me, she'll die too. And then everybody's like, hold the phones. And then she has a flashback to a thing that happened, which was one day he came to her after they had done like their profession of love, and was like, another rift has opened. I have to go do this fight. And she's like, oh no, you're gonna do a heckin' sacrifice. And he's like, don't worry about it, babe. And then he takes her star stick so that she can't portal to find him. And he goes to do the heckin' sacrifice. And she's like, no. And she's like, they actually haven't told each other they love each other yet. But anyway, she is so upset that she ends up portaling to him where he is, and she realizes, oh my god, I don't have my star stick, I have access to his power. And he like gets stabbed, like there's a bunch of creatures, they're gonna like they're doing a heckin' carnage, and she just goes like full on banshee, and she just like destroys everything. People, monsters, like just everything except for Grimm is just decimated. And they're like, oh my god, I heckin' love you, blah blah blah. And then she ends up dying. Like she just dies. And he brings her back to life with a mechanism and this might be because I didn't reread the first book, but apparently, because Oro goes, you didn't. And what you find out is that Grimm, to bring her back to life, bonded him to her somehow. in a way.
The magic in this world never makes a ton of sense, and so it's kind of just operating off of vague. You look like you're in so much pain.
I am. It's just so dumb. It's so dumb. Because, like, you're like, what is this bonding? Like, I know we talked about it with the animal. Like, she bonded her animal. That's the only time I remember that word being used, and, like, her mother died and Lynx didn't die, so obviously, like, that didn't work that way. And so it's just really weird. And so then Auro's like, no, I can't kill you, blah blah blah. And then there's this point where she realizes that her premonition she's had, that she thought was the future this whole time, and of how she would die, was actually that it was that memory from the past. She just didn't have the context to understand it. And so it was the past, and she's like freaking out about it. And she's like, I'm a monster. And Aura's like, no, no, no. And she does, the book literally almost word for word does what at the start of the second ACOTAR book, Feyre's like, I'm too broken. I'm a monster. I'm soiled. He shouldn't be with me. Tamlin shouldn't be with me. I'm covered in blood. I'm such a monster. And she literally does that, where she's like, Auro, don't touch me, I'm a monster, blah, blah, blah. And he's like, da, 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 da. And then Grimm goes, get your hands off my wife. And then that's the final twist, which is actually they've been married this whole time, and the necklace she's wearing is technically their wedding ring. There's a necklace that he gave her in the first book that she can't fucking get off. And it is a symbol of their, and why he didn't put it on her when she still remembered everything. And also, I thought the twist of the book was going to be that she was the one that asked for her memories to be wiped, but he just did it against her will, which is so fucked. And then sent her into the beginning of it. So she is literally married to a dude, unbeknownst to her, which, I mean, seeing as you guys didn't exchange the rings when she was consenting about it, I say you're not actually married.
Yeah, it's a good point, actually. Yeah.
Yeah. Like, legally, I would say, I say if this was brought to, yeah,
there's a strong case to be made.
Yeah, that it brought to a court of law, it would be voided. But anyway, and she realizes that, because she says to him, oh, God, that's the other thing. Oh, my fucking God. Before this battle, oh, God, I forgot. She, in one of her memories...
Which part?
The fucking vault. When she opens the vault...
Oh, that was so dumb.
She's informed. So she does, she goes in and she opens the vault, and Tara, that's her name, Tara, her one keeper, is there. So, like, I guess Grimm knew she was going to the vault and sent Tara there, because he's had Tara and Poppy this whole time, since Isla threw them out of the Wildling Realms. And Tara's like, ah, oh, you did it. You opened the realm. Lightlark is a mini-cosm of a larger world. This is another way where it feels very ACOTAR, because one of the things that I don't know if you know, Will, I think you do, all of the worlds in there are connected, and you can access different dimensions. Well,
it's a multiverse.
The multiverse for this series, the vault in the Wildling Palace is a portal to that other world. And Grimm and Cleo, the leader of the Moonlings, want to get to that world. The problem is, if you use that portal, it will destroy all of Lightlark. And Isla, like an idiot before she knew this, opened the portal. Like, and the thing is, she just opened the door, but now she can't fucking close it. Like, it's just so fucking... And they're like, oh, we're gonna use it. And she's like, no, don't do it. And she goes, if I come with you, will you leave? And he was like, yes, I will. And Oro's like, no, Isla, don't do it. And she was like, I love you, Oro, but I also love him. And then poofs off into existence. And that's it. That's the fucking book. You got this weird other dimension you have to... So here are all the things you have to deal with in the next book. You have a weird other world where apparently they can bring people back to life, which is why Cleo wants to go, because she had a son that died. And then also the way to save Isla, who is technically alive and fine. The only thing that will kill her is if What's-His-Face dies. So she's fine, but he's like, no, I have to save your... Like, it's saved. I don't understand why she's at risk. Like, are you trying to separate your bond? Like, what the fuck is happening? But anyway, you have that. You have Cinder being like the super powerful young child of, like, there's just so many dumb.
Well, and the thing is, they don't build on each other. So, for example, the stuff with the other world, this is not like we found out, oh, something that having, there was more going on with the curses than we realized. And the reason that the curses happened was because of this other world. It's literally just like, oh, this is just the next test we're going
to
go on.
I forgot something else that we have to deal with in the next one.
What?
So, there have been a group of rebels this entire time working against the king. And the rebels have been trying to get access to Isla, and then they do, and they're like, so it's really dumb that all of the kingdom's peoples are tied to their ruler, so there's a way to undo that, because that's actually a curse that the Nightshades put upon us a really long time ago before anyone remembers. And what the curse was is it took all the power from the people and put it into the rulers and made us dependent on them, because back in the day you could choose to no longer be wildling and stuff, and you've seen it because of those creatures we mentioned previously. And if you kill Aro...
Oh yeah, I'd forgotten about this, you're right.
Yes, if you kill Aro, we can all be free and everybody gets their own powers and the rulers aren't. And she's like, absolutely not, I'm not fucking killing Aro. And so I thought, like, something would happen that made, like, I thought when the oracle was like, you shall choose to kill one of them, I thought it was, like, there was going to be a moment where she's like, oh my god, to free everyone from the death that would befall them, I have to do this thing, you know? Like, nope, that just gets told to us and then you walk away, and that's another thread we have to deal with in the next book. And how does that connect to the, like, the other world and all this other, and then, like, dumb romance?
It's funny listening to us try to talk about it now.
It's worse.
Well, and I'm also a little bit worried that it didn't make a ton of sense and this was a little bit hard to follow. But the thing is, that's how I feel about the book, is that it was a little bit boring and hard to follow. Like, I can't quite remember what happens in large sections of this book, even to, like, criticize. It's not like Iron Flame, which just had awful stupid things happening constantly that, like, at least kind of pinged. This is just a lot of Isla being kind of insecure and going about her everyday life.
And the flashbacks, like, any tension you build up in the modern timeline, the flashbacks break that tension. Any tension you build up in the flashbacks are crashed by the, like the book is fighting against itself. It's like, it's one of the biggest problems when you have multiple viewpoints and multiple characters, is unless each of them are equally, and the problem is you have to cut the viewpoint at a decent point so that the next viewpoint doesn't suffer for it. Like, if you're going to end a chapter in one viewpoint, you have to end it in the right way so that the next chapter doesn't feel like, you're not like, oh my god, we're back in this, like, I'm dying to know what like, you have to be creative about it. And this book does that, but with the same character, but in flashbacks for half the book. And it is just rough. This book is so boring and a little nonsensical. And let's discuss the two things I saved. And there's a bunch of other things that happened, but I want to highlight these two phrases that she said. There's a point in the... These are both in the beginning because I had the wherewithal to do this at the time. Also, I tried to write Nightbane in my notes, and it auto-corrected to Nightbabe. And so the first one was, and because it was just such a dumb description, she said she felt, like, beaten down, like gems hammered into a sword. You don't hammer gems!
You can't. It will literally shatter the gem. The way you do it is you would make a socket in the actual, like, hilt or whatever, and then you would glue it in, and they had, like, glues back then or whatever to do it.
And then you can put a little bit of metal, you can put a little bit of metal around.
Yes, that's
it,
true. Yeah,
it,
yeah, you can also, like, claw it in like that, but, like, you don't hammer it. That makes no sense.
That's how you lose fucking gems. And then the first time it describes Grimm, it says it's a man, he was tall, blah blah, with relatively long black hair. What does that mean? Relatively? Like, are we in an in-between length? In that case, just say shoulder length, babe. Like, relatively long black hair, that is, it's vague.
That is really funny.
Well, it talks about using concrete descriptors rather than abstract descriptors. Relatively is an abstract descriptor. It is a terrible descriptor.
And it's super weak, too. Like, it's just, it can't decide whether it's one or the other. Like, if it was even medium, length hair would be better, because but relative is like a weird way of sanding off any edges. No, and that's the thing, is like, she's not a terrible writer a lot of the time. She got a lot of shit for a egg-shaped, yolk-shaped sun or whatever in the first book.
Yeah, a yolky thing. The sun was a yolky thing.
But she's like, she's fine overall. Again, her problems come from like characters and structure more than they do from like actual prose, which is, again, one of the reasons this feels weirdly like and not like a middle school book, because a middle schooler should not actually be able to write at this prose level. I don't know who I would recommend this book to. I guess I would recommend this to people who like ACOTAR but feel like sometimes it's a bit much. Like, you know what I mean? Like, it's trying a little too hard sometimes, and it's like, okay.
It's also shorter.
Is it really shorter? It feels so... Oh, yeah, you're right. It is much shorter, but it feels so long.
I think it's a similar length to the first book, but compared to the second and the third, this is way shorter.
It feels less leering with its sexuality than ACOTAR did, but it still has a lot in it. And, like, that was unpleasant to read. Yeah, I guess I would suggest this to people. I know this is not as going to be as funny as some of our other roast guys, but like, there just isn't a lot here. It's like a very, it's like a salad. Like, you eat it and you're like, well, I'm not full. That was just leaves.
And it's really just surface level. Like, and it's, I think because it isn't as long and it isn't as annoying, we don't have as much to say as like some of the other books that we've roasted, but it's like I said, it's a little nonsensical, it's a little surface level, it doesn't really fully engage with any of the ideas it presents.
It's just hard to remember, too.
I started this on Tuesday, there's no reason that the first half is as, like, I think I did a good job pretending like I knew what I was saying on this time, but there was a couple points I was like... I don't remember what happened during this section. And it's like, that's fine. You don't need to. The like core of the plot is unrelated to any of what that happened.
And I will say, she does build up a certain level of emotionality by the end, by the climax. But it's like, it's not really deserved. And it's sort of vapid. Again, Maria talked about how like nothing in this book really has impact. And that's really just the biggest problem with it. Nothing in this book really has impact. And it doesn't have, and it's not charming. Like, things cannot have impact if they're charming, but this isn't that. This isn't the, you know, Maria and I have talked before, and she has especially about how she likes like slice of life type of stuff. But like, that has to be charming, and it still has to have some kind of an impact. Yeah. And this is more just like, the author is overly interested in this character. Like, it really is. There's a mismatch.
And there's also just, it feels in a weird way, despite the fact that there's a ton of scenes with him, like, Aro is less of a character this one than he was last one.
He is!
He's just supportive golden retriever boyfriend.
Yeah, that's exactly what it... And the other thing is, I don't understand why they like each other. Like, I remember in the first book being like, oh, they actually have a little bit of chemistry. They have no chemistry here. At no point does the author retry to... And I don't even think she dislikes Aro. I think she just forgot to, or doesn't understand why they like each other.
Like, there's never a scene where I was like, aw, that's kind of, like, it's very functional, like, all of her effort is into the buildup of her, like, sometimes romances struggle when the characters actually get together, because, like, that's not, like, the juicy, nice parts, but if you know how to, like, handle your characters, and you have built up why they like each other, and also if you include, the thing is, you have to give both parties something to do that is not each other. Like, if your goal with the two of them is they're gotten together, the drama is no longer them, and is no longer the will they, won't they need character arcs that are happening separate of each other, that they support each other in. And, like, Aizen's kind of going through that, but Aro ain't doing shit. It's not like he's, like, because there's this one character who's, like, I like you, but I don't like you for him because you are making him soft as a ruler. And that's what he should be grappling with. She should find him in bed one day, or, like, just staring into the void one day and just, like, I did something terrible. And she's like, oh, my God, what happened? And then she realizes it. And they're both like, oh, my God, you're right. You're the fucking king. Like, what are we... And, like, having to deal with that and come to terms with that. How can you be a king and also be a good boyfriend? And, like... That ain't his arc, baby. Isla thinks about it more than he ever does. And, like, he needs to have an arc. He needs to feel like he has... And, like, he had that in the first book. He was dying. He needed to save his realm. He needed to break the curse. So he had something that outside of Isla, they ended up working on it together, but that he was doing outside of her and stuff. And this None of that shit. He just rules and preps for war.
Him and also the whole supporting cast actually is like that. There is no real supporting cast. Like, last book there was him, there was Grimm, and there was Celeste and like a few others. But like, this time the supporting cast is real weak. There's very little charm to them. I don't know. I just don't even know why you would want to write this book. Like, it's such a nothing of a book. And I think that's where I will rest my case. This is a nothing of a book.
It is. It's not one of the worst things we've read, but the thing is, it's also one of those where you talk about it and it gets worse.
Yes, no, that's true. Yeah, you're like, man, nothing really did happen, and some of these things really don't make sense that you just kind of let skate by.
And it's also funny because, like, you forget, like, I forgot the whole, like, if we kill Aro, then, like, everybody no longer has to be tied to their things, and that's what the rebels are doing, and, like, the rebels have no teeth, and there have been two scenes, and it's just so scattered. Don't read this book, maybe?
Yeah, I don't know that there's a reason to. If you've read the first book, I don't know that you're actually going to like this one more than you did, because something actually happened in that book, and nothing really happens here. There was at least some kind of energy. It reminds me a bit of Savior's Champion versus Savior's Sister, and that something happened in the first one in Champion, that in Sister nothing really happened, and so, like, you're losing energy, essentially. Yep. I don't know. It's not good, people. It's not good.
I don't know what to tell you. Don't. If you did and you liked it, that's fine. Again, I'm never here to take someone's joy, and I think I only realized how much I disliked the book now. I think we started this book rosier. And I wouldn't say rosier, but we started this book less dead, and I just feel very dead now inside. And I've realized that as we talked about it, it just got worse. And so, like, if you notice that I am angrier now than I was at the beginning, fair, I am. I don't like thinking about what happened in this book. It makes me sad. And if you do like thinking about what happened in this book, we just had different experiences, and that's okay.
All of that to say, this is not a very good book. Continue your media literacy journeys. Go watch instead our Keys to the Kingdom episode, and comment fish if you get 5 minutes in.
I do have last minute cat, because I don't think there's been a lot of
a kitten. No cat spottings. Yeah, that's true. Look at her.
Anyway, so that's it. Bye!